24ABR in Santa Cruz, online at kpfa.org. The time is 11 a.m. Stay tuned for the talkies.
Welcome to the Talkies. I'm very glad you could be here. I'm Chris Welch, your host, and coming up on the program today, we're going to talk about the present and the future and the past. So we got a lot to cover. We'd better get started. Later on in the program, we're going to be hearing from Blanche Wieson Cook, the brilliant historian who has just completed her trilogy of a biography of Eleanor Roosevelt, and talk about pertinent to this very day. It was wonderful to speak with her. It's an incredibly wonderful book that she's done about an amazing woman, and who would be so welcome right here today, wouldn't she? Everything she had to say and all the things she focused on. But we begin with a conversation about voting in the year 2016 and just how much like voting in, oh, say, 1920 or 1865, perhaps, is to this day. That's what's coming up. We start with Jennifer Clark at the Brennan Center. Lots of folks are looking at the election, trying to figure out what went wrong. And they're looking a lot at who voted and who didn't, but also who tried to vote and who couldn't. And, of course, this is not just a matter of the machines and stealing of votes. This is also a long-time established problem of restricting voter rights and disenfranchising voters. And one of the organizations in the United States that pays the best and closest attention to this and has for a long, long time is the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University School of Law. They do a lot of different things, a lot of different issues, and one of them is voting rights and elections. And we have joining us on the telephone at the moment Jennifer Clark, who is a counsel in the Brennan Center Democracy Program. I'm very glad she could spend some time with us. Good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon.
So I know beyond the details of who got how many votes where and how the Electoral College voted, well, that's all over. But there is an ongoing and very pervasive problem with the establishment or the maintaining of voting rights, period, in the country. How would you characterize it as just an overall?
Sure, certainly. So I would say that what we've really seen as we've been watching restrictions on the right to vote over, you know, the past decade or so, starting in about 2010 and really continuing for the past, you know, six going on 7 years, we've seen a real trend where states are making it a lot harder for people to vote. They're doing that by putting strict photo ID laws in place. They're doing that by cutting back on early voting opportunities, making it harder to register to vote. So we really, as I said, kind of saw that kick off around 2010 and saw a real surge in 2013 and onwards when the Supreme Court really gutted the Voting Rights Act and removed some of the protections that were in place for voters. So, you know, where we are today is certainly a worse place than we were, let's say, a decade ago with regards to Americans having access to the ballot. You know, we did see a little bit of a bright spot this summer where we saw a lot of courts pushing back against those laws, but as we're seeing some of the legislative sessions start up. You know, most states, their sessions come into play in January. We're seeing more and more bills being filed with politicians continuing to try to make it harder to vote.
And is this in a red-blue pattern, or is this sort of across the board? There's been more restrictive motion.
Sure. So there have been, you know, a couple of academic studies that have come out, you know, since this real uptick in restrictions on the right to vote, where political scientists primarily have taken a look at that exact correlation. And what they have found is that generally, as you see a state legislature move over toward Republican control, or as you see a governorship go over to Republican control, it becomes more and more likely that a state is going to pass a restrictive voting measure. So it certainly isn't one-to-one, and we have seen, you know, this be debated in states that people might consider, you know, blue states, and we have certainly seen some forward progress in, you know, what are traditionally red states, where they have done things like make online voter registration available. But generally speaking, the trend is that as a state government moves toward Republican control, it becomes more likely that we'll see restrictive laws being passed.
Well, some of the most restrictive laws that used to be in place were called Jim Crow laws, which actively prevented African-American folks from even registering back in the day. And there are many analysts and public affairs commentators who are saying that Jim Crow is back. And I note that the Brennan Center recently put out a report about Florida in particular, and Florida disenfranchising 1.6 million people. Is what of a correlation? I don't know if Jim Crow is the right word to use, but actively, especially people of color being disenfranchised.
So, you know, I think there has been a lot of you know, a lot of talk about, are we going back to that era? And while the types of restrictions that we're seeing now are, you know, a little bit more camouflaged in concerns over integrity and different things like that, at the end of the day, most of them do have a disproportionate impact on minority voters. You know, you mentioned the disenfranchisement for people with prior criminal convictions. That's certainly a huge one that has a vastly disproportionate impact, primarily on African-American citizens.
That was the Florida story, that they have Florida, get this, Florida has a lifetime voting ban for people with past criminal convictions, any criminal convictions or felony convictions. Not that that matters to me, but perhaps that's in the law.
It's a felony conviction, right? It's one of three states where there's a lifetime ban, so it's among the harshest of the laws in the entire country.
Wow. So Florida, what are the other two?
The other two states are Iowa, and then, you know, where there was some progress, and then unfortunately we made there was a little bit of backwards progress. We had a governor who you know, seemed interested in making some changes to that law, and then unfortunately we saw a backslide, and we've also seen a little bit, just to talk a little bit about the you know, the progress that I think is possible in this, is that we have you know, Florida, for example. You know, one of the reasons that we put out the report on Florida right now, to answer your question, Kentucky is the third state. One of the reasons we put out the report on Florida is because there has been a real movement that has come up from community leaders there, trying to, you know, make sure that the people in their community have the right to vote back, and they're actually trying to put a ballot question before Florida's voters in the 2018 election about, you know, changing that law in Florida. And, you know, that's a very positive sign. It actually got signed off on by the Secretary of State as being ready to go on the ballot. Now they just need to collect enough signatures. But, you know, Florida's one example. But we have saw, I think, a little bit in this past election season, which was not the most voter-friendly election season. But we did see some discussion around, you know, criminal justice issues and that being something that at least some, you know, candidates on both sides of the aisle were willing to talk about and how we need to reform that. And certainly disenfranchisement for people with criminal convictions is part of that. So, you know, I'm hopeful that this is an issue that could gain some bipartisan support because, you know, people, it's simply not fair for people to be paying for the rest of their lives. And it's not just those laws. You know, I mentioned strict photo ID laws. Those also have a disproportionate impact on minority voters. In Texas, for example, which has one of the strictest photo ID laws to vote in the country, it is much, much more likely that African-American voters and Hispanic voters will lack that ID and therefore have more troubles trying to vote. You know, a lot of experts have studied it, and they've all come to the same conclusion that it has a racially discriminatory impact.
And in fact, the Brennan Center was among those filing suit challenging that strict voter ID law on behalf of the Texas State Conference of the NAACP and the Mexican American Legislative Caucus. We're talking with Jennifer Clark, who is a counsel in the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University School of Law, celebrating 20 years of work on a lot of different topics, including money in politics, government and court reform, justice for all, liberty and national security. They have advocacy work in court cases, policy proposals, legislation, etc., and they do publications. And she is working on the voting rights angle. And what has the Brennan Center been doing besides this court case? I know that you are actively engaged in trying to encourage policy that will liberate voters rather than restrict them.
Yes, you know, it's very important not just to focus on the negative, but to really look at ways to affirmatively move the right to vote forward. And that's something that, you know, we are equally focused on. One of the other big stories from 2016 was the real explosion of, and I'm sure, you know, those in California know this, of support for automatic voter registration. In 2015, we saw two states, Oregon and California, pass it, and then we saw four more states pass it into law in 2016, and that includes some, you know, red states, to kind of circle back to what we were talking about before, West Virginia and most recently Alaska. The voters at the ballot box just approved a measure to bring automatic voter registration there. So that.
And when you say automatic, you mean what, with driver license application, or what is it? What makes it automatic?
Sure, generally speaking. So what makes it automatic is that currently in most states in the country, you have to affirmatively say that you want to be registered to vote, and taking the step is getting yourself on the rolls. What automatic voter registration does is it flips that, and it uses government lists. In many cases, that is DMV lists, although it doesn't need to only be that, but generally it is so far. And it says, okay, if you, you know, interact with the DMV and you're an eligible citizen, we're going to register you to vote automatically unless you say you don't want to be registered. So it flips the default.
Excellent.
So that people don't have to take a step to get registered. They instead take a step to get unregistered. And as we've seen in Oregon, which is the state that has put it into place so far, it not only succeeds in growing the rolls, which it has done, but it also succeeds in growing turnout. In their most recent election, in the presidential election there was a huge number of people who had been registered to vote automatically and who then turned out to vote. About 40% of the new registrants actually did vote in the presidential election.
Excellent.
This idea that if people cared, they would get registered, it's simply not true. We just need to make it, you know, as seamless as possible, and that's what automatic voter registration does.
Now, registration is one thing, but I just get so frustrated that each individual state has so much power to determine who votes and whose vote is counted. We're not talking about the counting part. We're just talking about the voting part right now, with saying, oh, no, you can only vote between the hours of this and this on this date. There's no There's no early voting. There's no many days in which to vote. There's and even mail-in votes. It's I can't imagine what it would take to get federal legislation that would address this issue, although it certainly seems that it is a federal issue.
Certainly. So, you know, it is a little bit of a tricky situation when it comes to voting because our Constitution does leave a lot of control in states' hands. You know, sometimes that's a really great thing because it lets states that are more interested in helping people vote.
Like Oregon, yes.
Yeah, like take a step out ahead and say, this is a good thing. Look how much it's helping us. Other states, please follow. But, of course, it does also have negative effects because a state can, you know, really go too far in the other direction and make it very difficult for voters to vote. And it is, you know, you highlight another thing, which is that elections are run at a very local level in our country. That makes us very different from many other democracies in the world where elections are administered federally. So, you know, in some ways it's nice because rules can be adjusted to fit the community, but what that also means is you get a Byzantine system that voters need to work their way through, and what it means is that it's really up to localities to inform voters, and what we see far too often is, you know, that everybody's overworked or they're just not keeping up to date and they're giving out bad information. You know, we saw that in many states this year where, for example, you know, the law that I mentioned in Texas, over the summer, a court finally stepped in and said that Texas needed to do something to give people who don't have ID the right to vote. And so there was supposed to be this alternate process for those people to go through. But we saw time after time that it wasn't being offered to voters at the local level, and stuff was just falling through the cracks.
Mm-hmm.
And when you administer elections so locally, unfortunately, that is something that happens.
In Michigan, they were going to make it harder for people to vote.
Yes. There was a bill that luckily got tabled for now.
Anyway, oh, good.
To put strict voter ID law into place there. You know, it's an unfortunate side effect, I think, of a lot of the really regrettable rhetoric that we saw during the election about how the election was rigged and how, you know, this state and this state had a bunch of, you know, fraudulent votes. And talk like that, it really emboldens those who, you know, are looking for their opening to make it more difficult for people.
Well, and from your research, that's talk, but what are the facts? Is there a great deal of voter fraud like that?
No, you know, it does happen, but it's a very, very, very small phenomenon. You know, we have information up on our website that basically compiles every court that's looked at it, every study that studied it, every expert that's pontificated on it, and they all come to the same conclusion, which is it's very, very rare. You know, to give one example, you had a study that was done by a law professor and was published in the Washington Post that found, you know, 31 instances out of about a billion ballots cast over about a 10-year period. So, you know, that comes down to 0.000, I can't even say all the 1%. But when you get these strict photo ID laws in place, you see a lot more than that percentage of people who are running into trouble, you know, finding the ID that they need to vote. Mm-hmm. So it really, the math doesn't work out.
Jennifer Clark, a counsel for the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center in their Voting Rights and Elections topic section. And the Brennan Center for Justice is at the New York University School of Law, and I recommend them to your attention. It's brennancenter.org, and they have a signature proposal which would modernize voter registration system and add an additional 50 million voters to the rolls permanently. Let's work on that, help them advocate for that. Thank you, Jennifer, so much for spending some of your time with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
McGinnis and the album Bolero, All Blues. So that's that. And now we turn to yesteryear, really, although there is one of the National Protection of Social Security Organizations has an Eleanor Project going right now, meaning Eleanor Roosevelt. She is very much pertinent to the world that we live in today. And I was blessed to speak with Blanche Wiesen Cook, and we're going to hear that conversation right now. She's the biographer of, among other people, Eleanor Roosevelt.
I honor the human race. When it faces life head on, it can almost remake itself. In the long run, we shape our lives and we shape ourselves. The process never ends until we die, and the choices we make are ultimately our own responsibility. The purpose of life, after all, is to live it, to taste experience to the utmost, to reach out eagerly and without fear for newer and richer experience. And you can do that only if you have curiosity, an unquenchable spirit of adventure. The experience can have meaning only if you understand it, if you have arrived at some knowledge of yourself, a knowledge based on a deliberately and usually painfully acquired self-discipline, which teaches you to cast out fear and frees you for the fullest experience of the adventure of life. The words written in 1960 of Eleanor Roosevelt.
And you learn by living. She said she lived her life as an adventurer.
Indeed. Blanche Wiesen Cook, our guest on the telephone, biographer of Eleanor Roosevelt, and in fact she has just completed the third of her trilogy of the life of Eleanor Roosevelt, and this is the Eleanor Roosevelt, The War Years and After, 1939 to 1962. Of course, an incredible woman, 1884 to 1962. What a lifespan, and what she did with it. She was amazing.
She really was.
Talk to me about how you first began deciding to explore and elucidate the life of Eleanor Roosevelt.
Well, you know, I always say my life was an accident because I was a gymnast and I had an accident and I couldn't major in phys ed and go to the Olympics. And so I had to major in anthropology and political science and history. Every course I took was as exciting as sports, it turned out. And then I was working on Eisenhower, the declassified Eisenhower, in Abilene, Kansas, which was a dry town. You couldn't even get wine with dinner. And I had some friends there, but a friend's, Kate Stimson, who is the editor of Signs, sent me books to review. And one of the books was this really mean story that someone named Doris Faber had written, really upset that Eleanor Roosevelt and Rena Hickok might have had real affection for each other, maybe even an affair. And she wrote a kind of awful book saying these letters couldn't possibly mean what they seemed to mean. And so I wrote a review of the book and then returned to New York from Abilene when my research was over. And by the time my Eisenhower book, The Declassified Eisenhower, was published, I called Joe Lash. It was about that time, who was a friend of mine. And Joe Lash was Eleanor Roosevelt's sort of chosen son and her biographer. And he had blurred my Crystal Eastman book. This is a book that should stay in print forever. And you get to be friends with people who blurb your books like that. And I said, Joe, what's up with you not having Hick in your book, in your work at all? And he said, well, I hated her. Let's have dinner and talk about it. And Joe Lash really did hate Lorena Hickok because she was a bit of a racist and an anti-Semite. And the bottom line is that he encouraged me to write about Eleanor Roosevelt. And at the time, God has forgive me, I said, don't be ridiculous. I'm a military historian. I do hard history. And he said, you know, you're wrong. And he took me up to Hyde Park, where I saw that he was the good son. Anything Eleanor Roosevelt wanted to deal with, he dealt with. Anything she didn't want to deal with, he didn't deal with. And then she said, I don't care about power. And he wrote, she didn't care about power. And I knew I had a story. But I thought I could finish it by her. This was 1982. I thought I could finish it by her centennial, 1984. And then as I started to work, one thing led to another, and more information turned up, and the story got bigger and bigger. And for me, one of the things, one of Joe Lash's legacies is he always said Eleanor Roosevelt was infinite, and she is infinite. She's amazing. I worked for about 6 or so years at the State Department because my at the historical office declassifying documents. And my boss at the State Department historical office would send me really mountains of material to research, to think about. He said, this is what we're going to talk about at our next meeting, and this is what I want you to think about. And one day I said to him, look at all the material you send me. What do you think Eleanor Roosevelt's State Department file looks like all the years she spent, 1946 to 1953? He said, well, let's look for it. And we did. We went to the National Archives and found 198 boxes of her human rights record and her fight for, you know, U.S. policies at the end of the Cold War, at the end of World War II. And during the Cold War, so it's, you know, again, 198 boxes, we declassified them. There's much more still to write, but she was totally amazing. And that's why Volume 1 is, you know, the early years, and Volume 2 of the years is first the first two terms is First Lady, and Volume 3 are the war years and after. And it's really quite a story. She's amazing. And she never stopped growing and changing and had a great vision for human rights for all people.
Indeed, the United Nations Human Rights Declaration is, she was part of writing that, if not prime author.
She's not the prime author so much as she's the prime negotiator.
Mm.
And she really, it's her brilliant diplomacy and her caring diplomacy that, you know, makes it happen so that the Soviets don't vote against it. And she, at one point, Harry Truman, who appointed her to the UN, encourages her not to vote no on the economic and social rights of the UN Declaration of Human Rights. And Eleanor Roosevelt says, no, you can't talk human rights to people who are hungry. And so and she says, if you want me to do that, I will resign. And he says, no, don't resign. Follow your courage. Follow your convictions. And she always said, courage can be as contagious as fear. And so the Universal Declaration of Human Rights is this important beacon of hope for the future, which includes the civil and political rights and the economic and social rights. But she does agree to a compromise, and it's two covenants, and the U.S. has still not had a conversation about the covenant for economic and social rights, and it took a very long time for the U.S. to ratify the civil and political rights covenant, which was finally ratified by the U.S. When the Soviet Union collapsed. George Herbert Walker Bush agreed to have it ratified.
It's indeed, the echoes of so many of the moments of her life in today's politics, in today's political life.
Right.
I think of race primarily right now for some reason. Given the KKK marching, celebrating the president-elect that we are now burdened with, in my view.
Yes, and we have an American Nazi Party that I think people really could not believe would celebrate the election of a president. Donald Trump is, you know, endorsed and celebrated by the KKK and the American Nazi Party.
But lest we think that this is like new, or that this is more virulent now than it was then, the tales you tell of, you talk about courage and standing up for convictions, she was incredibly persistent despite
dissuading, on the very least, by everyone, including her husband, the president. She was just relentless.
Well, I think that we really haven't dealt with how racist this country has continued to be. And I think the big surprise for those of us who were surprised by what happened in this election is, you know, I was in Washington last week, and I went to the new African American History Museum, which is fabulous. But one of the most important statements on the, you know, in the mural is Dr. W.E.B. Du Bois's "The History of the 20th Century is the History of the Color Line." And then they have added, "And the history of the 21st century is the refusal to acknowledge the color line." And that's where we are in this moment. And it really is very interesting. Eleanor Roosevelt and FDR had an agreement. She really trusted him. She believed that they shared a vision. And she understood that he needed to negotiate with what we now call a Dixiecrat-dominated Congress. The Democrats were dominated by the Southern and racist Democrats who did not want to integrate anything and who did not want to integrate the military, even while we're fighting for, quote, freedom and democracy. And Eleanor Roosevelt says you can't, if we're going to be a beacon of democracy, we have to end our own racism and segregation. And it's really fascinating. You know, we've just seen Attorney General J. Edgar Comey did to Hillary Clinton. Well, J. Edgar Hoover did Eleanor Roosevelt. And he tapped her phones, he bugged her hotel rooms, and he created this huge file that is more than 4,000 pages. And 80 to 90% of her file is what she says against race violence, against lynching, against segregation. And he calls her terrible names. That old cow is meeting with her communist friends again. And any integrationist in the 40s and 50s was accused of communism. You had to be red if you were against segregation.
Here's a quote from Eleanor Roosevelt from 1942 in her column. She had a regular column, newspaper column. "Today, what concerns us most deeply is the necessary change in attitude on the part of the white race. The psychology which believes that the white man alone of all the races in the world has something which must be imposed on all other races must go," which is a reference not only to the situation for colored people in the United States, but also to the clamorings for independence on the part of India at the time.
Right.
So which of the three, when I started reading this volume, you're listening to the Blanche Wiesen Cook, distinguished professor of history at John Jay College and Graduate Center at the City University of New York. And in addition to her trilogy, your three-volume biography of Eleanor Roosevelt, her other books include, as she's mentioned, The Declassified Eisenhower and Crystal Eastman on Women and Revolution. Of the three volumes, when I started reading, I thought, oh, I want to read about when she was little and when she was a child, this poignant story of her terrible childhood and her rejection by everyone on all sides. And but then I start reading this one, and I was so grateful for your scholarship and for your research, because we can think of her or anyone in history with these moments, but here you forget that every single day things are happening, every day there are developments. And it was so to arrive at those big moments takes so much effort in all of the little ones. It's an incredible tribute to this woman's stamina, among other things.
It really is. I just want to go back to her childhood.
Yes, please do.
Because everybody always asks me, you know, how did she get to be that way? here she is, the privileged daughter of affluent people, the niece of Theodore Roosevelt, the Rough Rider, you know, a famous family. How did she get to be a person who went around the country and around the world identifying with people in want, in need, in trouble? And the answer to that is very simple. People in want and need, in trouble, just like her own family. Her mother died when Eleanor Roosevelt was 8. She essentially turned her face to the wall. And her father died when Eleanor Roosevelt was 10, at the age of 34, of alcoholism. And you really need to pause and ask, how much do you have to drink to die at the age of 34 of alcoholism? And what was her family life like? Well, we know it was in want, in need, in trouble. And so her identification and concern for everybody is really built and charged with her concern for her own family. And Lady Stella Redding, her great friend, the wonderful British hero during World War II, who plays a significant role in this volume, said Eleanor Roosevelt's first love was the people. And it really was. She went around the country and around the world with two questions. Tell me, what do you want? What do you need? And she put it all together very early. We need movements for social change. You can't depend on politicians to do anything about our essential needs. And our essential needs are very clear. Everybody needs education, housing, health, and dignity. And from the 1920s forward, she is fighting. She is trooping for democracy, building movements for democracy so that everybody will have enough to eat and everybody will have excellent free public education. As early as 1943, before Bernie Sanders, in 1943, Eleanor Roosevelt called for free public higher education and training for everybody. Everybody needed jobs. Everybody needed economic security. And then she said, when everybody is educated and everybody has health and housing and something to do that they care about, we will have peace. And that's really important.
So from her own very lonely childhood, and also she was not the most gorgeous child or adult that anyone ever saw, she yet had her own spirit and a great eagerness therein, and this love of her, of people and of the world. And then she marries her distant cousin, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, destined to become the President of the United States for 4 terms. And there was a love match, even though his mother was interfering, to say the least. And then she discovers he's having an affair, and about, they got married in, what, 1905, and by 1918 she discovers an affair with Lucy Mercer.
Right.
And in fact, Lucy Mercer is with him when he dies, many years later, 1944. So
45.
Yeah. And in a way, and you write about her sitting for hours on end in front of this statue entitled Grief, or that she called Grief, in a cemetery, which was depicting a wife, another betrayed wife, who in fact had committed suicide out of her
Henry
grief.
Adams' mm-hmm. wife, who was a poet and a writer and a translator and a scholar, really, a scholar poet. And she commits suicide when she finds out about Henry Adams' affair.
With her friend.
Yes.
But so meanwhile, it's almost as if this discovery of an affair on the part of her husband liberated her into great grief, but beyond that, to becoming what she became to her husband, who went on to have several other affairs, as far as
right.
we can determine, as his still very closely tied together and loving each other, but with this what would you call it, that they could not connect on some ways, but he relied on her so heavily for all of their marriage.
Well, they really had a kind of political partnership. He trusted her. She's her eyes and her ears, and I mean his eyes and ears and his conscience, and he depended on her, and she trusted that, you know, his basic instinct was in agreement with hers, and it was a matter of timing. So she trusted him to do the right thing ultimately, and her role, she realized, was to push him. You know, he always said to people, make me do it. Well, her goal was to build movements that would make him do it. And I think the affair and grief and her way out of her, what she called her Griselda moods, great moments of deep depression, was to work really hard so that she had a syndicated column. She's the first lady of radio. She writes dozens of books and countless articles a month. She's really an incredibly intense working person. But everything she does is to make life better for all people. And what she says is government exists for only one purpose, to make life better for all people. So that she really is a visionary and the conscience of this country and of democracy, and gives us hope, beacon of hope at this incredible time. I also think that their parallel, that their partnership and their marriage and their parallel court liberated her to have her own support network, which she has and he supports. And then Missy LeHand comes in to his life, and she treats Missy LeHand as the junior wife, and she's very grateful and relieved for Missy LeHand. And then she has her besties, who she's sort of a serial romantic, and she moves from one person to another over time.
Male and female, as we may could say.
Male and female, mm-hmm. ending with Joe Lash and Truda Lash, who is a great hero in this book that really hasn't been written about successfully. I mean, in the way she deserves to be written about. I hope somebody will write a biography of this incredible woman, Gertrude von Adam Wenzel Pratt Lash, who is really responsible for the Varian Fry rescue operation, and does extraordinary work over time.
Blanche Wiesen Cook, speaking about the final third volume in her three-volume biography of Eleanor Roosevelt, The War Years and After 1939 to 1962. So I talked earlier of how I was struck by how it's these tiny little moments, or maybe I just think of them as tiny little moments because I've forgotten them or I didn't live through them, and I thought, whoa, that was amazing. And all of the times that the State Department got in the way or actively tried to prevent
blocked refugees from coming in.
So the war years, the war begins, and there's the battle, of course. Is the United States going to go in or not? And she is on one. Talk about how that developed, that whole consciousness about to engage or to remain isolated.
Well, there is a great isolationist movement, and you bring in this question in 1939. There's the king and queen of England are visiting when this sad ship filled with 900 refugees, the SS St. Louis, is being turned back, is not allowed to land anywhere at any port. And the 900 refugees, you know, the ship of tears, and the papers for this moment when the king and queen are in the United States at the White House, at Hyde Park, the front page is shared with the ship, the SS St. Louis, and the royal visit. And the royal visit was to get the U.S. out of its isolationism and to realize that we really do want to defend England and this royal, this charming royal couple. We don't want them to die. So we have to get out of our isolationism. But the ship is allowed to go back. And this refusal to save refugees and to save Jews and to save the primary victims of Hitler's onslaught is a theme that runs through it. And it's not until 1944 that Henry Morgenthau, with Ruth Gruber, who died on November 17th at the age of 105, who's one of the heroes of the book, create the only one haven in Oswego for, you know, for about 1,000 refugees.
Which FDR almost reluctantly agrees to sanction.
Right, but he does.
Yeah.
And it is, you know, it is the only one. And then Eleanor Roosevelt is all involved with the Variant Fry rescue operation, which saves some other people, the best and the brightest, great learned heroes, Pablo Casals and Hannah Arendt, and, you know, just extraordinary writers and artists and so on. But there's a very nasty, evil, in my opinion, man named Breckinridge Long. And it's Breckinridge Long who runs the State Department and is in charge of all of these decisions, who's going to be let in and who's not going to be let in.
Well, he's in charge of what FDR even called the Jewish problems.
Right. And he says no. What happens after the SS St. Louis is sent back, which Eleanor Roosevelt is silenced about, she's, you know, FDR, do not talk about this now, and she doesn't. But she says this isn't going to happen again, and the next ship is called the Kwanzaa, Q-U-A-N-Z-A. And Eleanor Roosevelt says, I'm going to let the refugees on the Kwanzaa come in as my guests. And there are 80 of them, and with her allies, 80 people are allowed to enter. And this drives Breckinridge Long out of his mind, and he complains, and he gets FDR to agree that he is the only person who makes decisions, and that and they're all going to be delay, and they're not coming in until 1944, when Henry Morgenthau in the Treasury Department says, no, we're going to bypass the State Department altogether and create an emergency war refugee board. And that's the origins of Ruth Gruber and Harold Dickies and Haven, which Eleanor Roosevelt supports. But it's really, for me, a great mystery. Why didn't FDR fire Breckinridge Long? And he never did.
Yes, he showed his displeasure, as Breckinridge Long mentions in his diary, late in the career, and Mr. Long resigns, finally,
right,
because he's aware that he no longer has the
right
support of the president.
Yep.
But this again ties me to what's happening today, and whoever this our president-elect names as Secretary of State, it really has a big impact, and I was absolutely stunned to read about the report to the secretary on the acquiescence of this government in the murder of the Jews, which was generated by the then Secretary of the Treasury, I believe, Henry Morgenthau,
right,
looking to try to expose State Department obstructionism under Mr. Long, I believe.
Yes. Yes. And that's when finally he resigned.
Yes. So this was it was absolutely horrifying. There were several cables, for example. One documented the 1943 terror in Poland, where 6,000 Jews were killed each day, and in Romania, where 130,000 Jews had been deported to Transnistria in Romanian-occupied Ukraine. And the other cable urged silence about the ongoing slaughter.
Right.
And it's that you say that when the team showed Morgenthau the bitter evidence, he became physically ill. And so then they present the report to FDR at the White House.
Right.
And what does FDR do then? Just that's when he sort of shuns Mr. Long.
Yes. He allows the War Refugee Board to do its work, which is to begin to save people and get them out of harm's way.
But this is already so late in the war.
And, you know, Auschwitz is not bombed. Everybody thought it could be and should be. Plants, factories near Auschwitz were bombed, so nobody knows why it wasn't. And these are mysteries that are going to continue forever.
Mm.
Why wasn't more done when so much more could have been done? And then when Eleanor Roosevelt in 1946 visits Zelchheim and the other, you know, relocation camps where people are still lingering, still waiting to be admitted somewhere, she writes, "We did nothing to prevent this tragedy. Now we have to work to avenge it." But her admission that we did nothing to prevent it is really important.
Another echo, perhaps, in our futures and present, we have...
Which is why we have to organize.
Mm, amen.
And fight. I mean, you know, all of us are going to march, as I've been saying to everybody, we must march again, my darlings. Our movements are building. This can't be, you know, we cannot have a fascist reality.
So here we have, this is in 1940 in the spring, an extraordinary wave of anti-communist and anti-alien bigotry and violence emerged in the United States, culminating in the passage on the governmental level of the Alien Registration Act, or the Smith Act.
Right.
And this was introduced by Congressman Howard Smith, Democrat from Virginia. And it's fascinating to me, too, the evolutions of the Democrat and Republican parties. Wendell Willkie, the Democratic nominee for president in 1940, was quite the liberal, actually, on race and all kinds of things. He wanted small government, but he was a liberal on almost everything else.
Well, he was a really great liberal, and he put race on the agenda so that FDR had to deal with it because Willkie put it there. And then they become friends. It's a really interesting story. And FDR sends... First, he sends Willkie around the world, and around the world tour in 1942. And Willkie has an epiphany. Everything that happens anywhere affects everybody, everywhere. We are all connected, one world. And that becomes Eleanor Roosevelt's mantra. She thinks that is perfect. That's what she's been saying, she says, all along. And it really is. And then in 1944, FDR and Willkie have a discussion about running together and creating a new party that's a genuinely progressive party. But Wendell Willkie, whose biography still needs to be written, and good people are working on that, is a man who drinks too much, eats too much, loves too much, and dies of multiple heart attacks one day of much too much. And so that
he was only 54.
Yes, he was very young. And I dedicate my book, the volume 3. I wrote, this book is dedicated to all those activists and agitators who resist tyranny, challenge authority, fight for peace, freedom, and human rights as we continue our journey for one world, no borders, no boundaries, no walls. And I wrote that, of course, long before this election.
Mm-hmm. Blanche Wiesen-Cook, our guest on the telephone with the third volume in her trilogy biography of Eleanor Roosevelt. This is being the war years and after 1939 to 1962. And there was so many things that you educate us about, and the waste spaces for waste people, the debate about where will the Jews go in Palestine, and the search for the waste spaces for waste people, and the her tour of the South Pacific in 1943, you say it was the longest and most perilous of her career, just beautiful. And all her work for race equality in the United States, it's really heartwarming. And I just miss her all over again, and even though I was too young to have truly experienced everything about her. In her final, what would you say, you have your epilogue about her most lasting legacy, what would you say?
Well, her most important legacy is the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. But her, you know, which really is and remains for the whole world a beacon of hope. If we can get everybody to agree this is the world's right, everybody has to have civil and political rights, freedom, democracy, dignity, work, education, health care, you know, dignity and economic security, we'll have peace. So I really think it remains the beacon of hope. The other thing that is her lasting legacy is her activism. I was student body president at Hunter College in 1961-62, when Eleanor Roosevelt, I invited her to speak, and she told us to go south for freedom. And so we did. We took two buses to North Carolina, and we sat in. And that commitment to social change, to activism, her trust in young people to continue the work that needs to be done, so resonates for this moment. And I have to say, my own students are right there. What can we do? What should we do? They want to be scholars and activists. And that's what we need, and that's what she encouraged folks to do.
And that's what people will be encouraged to do by reading your book and all your writings about her. Blanche Wiesen-Cook, a distinguished professor of history at John Jay College and Graduate Center at the CUNY, City University of New York. And this is the final in her biography of Eleanor Roosevelt, The War Years and After, 1939 to 1962, Volume 3. Madam, I thank you so much for spending some of your day with us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Chris. I really appreciate it.
And we really appreciate you, to all of you folks who have been there for KPFA, listening and supporting. And just another reminder that by the end of the year, before the 31st of December, you can donate freely online at kpfa.org and get a tax write-off and support the station, of course. Very grateful to have you here, and very grateful for Kristen Thomas at the controls. And I'll see you same time, same station tomorrow. Have a good one.
Rebecca Solnit says, it's the poignant story of someone who started out feeling like the only gay person in the entire world and ends up organizing millions of gay folks. Cleve Jones, long in the San Francisco heart of the struggle for gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender rights, helped change gay history. He'll tell the story Wednesday evening, January 25th, 7:30 p.m. at St. John's Presbyterian Church, 2727 College Avenue in Berkeley. This KPFA benefit has wheelchair access and free parking. Tickets at brownpapertickets.com or our great independent bookstores. Richard Walensky.